I guess you were a fellow here for 2 years before you were hired as a staff. I don't really know what the proper term is. And I just would ask you what the transition was like from Minnesota. Were you recruited here? You just knew you had finally, as you said, if you're from the East Coast, you'd never heard of University of Chicago. But once you move out of that orbit, you find out about it real quickly. How did you come to, you know, how did it come about that you're here?
I was not recruited. I was in my fellowship there, and I decided that I wanted to do more research training because I felt that I wanted to do more research work, at least for a period of time, as intensively as I possibly could. And I wasn't really fully trained for that at the end of the 3 years in Minnesota. So Janet Rowley is the head of the sort of chromosome program here, and she's very famous. Everybody knows her. I knew about her. She's, you know, wrote many papers. And her associate Michelle LeBeau, also, who is a young person, was, you know, rapidly becoming very, very famous in the area of chromosome abnormalities and leukemia. And I was well aware of their work because they wrote many papers in a short period of time and were just very well known. And so I heard Michelle LeBeau speak at a meeting while I was in Minnesota, and I went up to her and asked her if there was any opportunity for, you know, training after I left Minnesota, and she said definitely, and, you know, send your CV to Dr. Rowley. And I did that, and they invited me down here for an interview, and I ended up taking the position.
That was 2 years more of, again, training, working, I guess, really in the cytogenetics lab and doing research with the both of them. And actually, it seems like quite a large group of people in the lab.
Right.
A lot of them MDs as well, I mean, including Molly and LeBeau, right?
Dr. LeBeau has just a PhD. Dr. Rowley happens to have an MD, and it's in a department of hematology, so a lot of the doctors that were in the area that we, you know, met with every day were physicians. So there was a lot of clinical influence there, so that we were very in touch with what was happening with the patients. We received samples of bone marrow from patients, and we knew a lot about the patients because the doctors were there to talk to us about it, and that was very, you know, helpful.
What exactly did you start doing when you got here? Was it just, you know, in other words, part of the task of the lab that that were leading to other people's, in other words, was something new developed because you were here, there was an extra body, and what were you interested in? And, well, let's start that as well.
Well, I started out just doing the basic, you know, technical work of cytogenetics, which I already learned in Minnesota, but in cancer cytogenetics, it's a very difficult field to learn because many of the samples that we received had tremendous numbers of complicated chromosome abnormalities, so it takes, you know, quite a few years to get skilled at analyzing the chromosomes, and so I needed more experience with that, and that was certainly one of the key, you know, major jobs that I had. Right away was to analyze cases, analyze real clinical cases, and get more experience doing that. But at the same time, I had enough extra time to develop on my own, you know, different questions that I had or that I would like to try and answer. Part of it was to try and correlate the chromosome abnormalities with the clinical features of the patients and see what they meant in terms of whether they signaled anything about the disease, whether it signaled anything about what the diagnosis actually was, or whether it signaled anything about how well the patient was going to do or not do. And Dr. Rowley already had a lot of questions there as well, but hadn't had time to carry them out. So, you know, we talked together quite a bit about what questions we had and what was important and what we wanted to do. And in doing that, put together a few relatively small projects, which involved simply comparing the cytogenetics with the features of the patients and seeing if there's anything common about them. And so that resulted in a variety of projects.
And how would you, and maybe this is getting back to something we've already discussed, maybe we can give it some kind of concrete or particular emphasis, and that's, is this where you were kind of finding that more work needed to be done, both in basic research and the correlation between that research and patients to really have this kind of payoff in the way of better treatment or more exact treatment, that the correlations you were trying to set up still weren't leading to anything final in that sense, or was there?
Well, the correlations were they were a form of retrospective study, because we would do the cytogenetic analysis and we have entered all this information into a computer, and then we could ask the computer, you know, give us a list of all the patients that had a translocation between chromosome 3 and chromosome 21, and then it would give a printout of 5 patients, and we'd get the charts and we'd see, oh, all these patients have the same diagnosis, all these patients died within 1 month, here's a correlation, this is interesting, we ought to let people know if patients have a 321 translocation, you better watch out because they're not going to do very well, you know, that kind of thing. But it was a retrospective study, and it had limited significance because of that. You know, what would be much more significant was to take that seed of information and then to go into a prospective study where, as patients came in, you identified what the chromosome abnormality was and then said, well, let's test a hypothesis. If we treat those patients more intensively,
will we prolong their
will
lives,
we do better?
Right, past that year?
Or vice versa. If there was a chromosome abnormality that was associated with a great prognosis, could we treat them less? And getting to the prospective studies, well, we were planting seeds for prospective studies by doing that, and that's what we were doing, and that was, you know, one could consider that to be perfectly fine. I'd say it still was a little bit, you know, disappointing in terms of the amount of time that it takes to get to anything that really has an impact, but I think it was somewhat satisfying to plant these seeds.
And they're being, I mean, somebody's kind of tending, I mean, I assume you as well, but again, whether you're in the lab yourself doing kind of hands-on work, I take it these seeds are kind of being watched and maybe a little bit of fertilizer is being put on in there. They're being tended, I take it. Even if you're, you know, your direct involvement is, it may have been cut back somewhat. This is still going on. I mean, there's still the hope and realization that this will pay off probably somewhere down the line. It's just a while to go.
Mm-hmm.
Have you much interest in also talking about the technical work that you did, just the technical aspects of it? Again, a few applications that people were quite impressed with your ability to take some techniques and develop them for uses that, to find out things that you needed to find out, so you kind of worked on that. Would you...
Well, the only technique was this pulse field gel electrophoresis that would be, you know, unique. One of the problems that came up in molecular biology was that many genes were very large. And in being so large, the standard technique of DNA analysis, which was Southern blot analysis, was inadequate because you only were analyzing very small regions of DNA, which were well within inside a gene. And so if you're only analyzing a tiny little area of it, there could be mutations or abnormalities that were outside that area that that you'd be missing and couldn't identify. And so a technique was developed in yeast genetics that's called pulse field gel electrophoresis, where you could look at very large pieces of DNA. And it's really just a variation on Southern blot analysis, but nevertheless, you could look at large pieces of DNA so that these big genes were contained within those pieces, and if there was any rearrangement of it, you'd be able to detect it. And we had chromosome abnormalities, and we had probes, but the probes didn't detect anything, and we thought that it was because either the gene was far away from the probe, or the probe was within a huge gene, and we just couldn't get close enough to the rearrangement. And so we used pulse field gelectrophoresis, and maybe we were one of the first groups to actually apply it to cancer work, human cancer work, and we're able to immediately see the rearrangements or the mutations in whereas otherwise they were, you know, basically not a, you know, unidentifiable, and that was really exciting.
And this was a group kind of realization. I mean, you were reading something in some way, you know, one day, and about, you know, it was yeast genetics, and here's this great way of, you know, getting at the larger chunks of DNA and the bigger genes, and you said, wait, this is exactly what we should be trying on, aren't they? Or somebody called you up on the phone and said, hey, you should be doing it this way. I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how it was decided that...
Well, people here already recognized that it could be an important tool for of this work just as I was sort of coming in here.
And you were the one who figured out.
And I was the sort of the student that was said, well, let's work on this.
And you were, in a sense, kind of the leader in figuring out, well, yes, it needs to be done. We just need to make it work for us and maybe fiddle with the process a little bit or even a lot.
That was the main thing. I fiddled with the process. Mm-hmm. I hung around and I came in at night and I came in on the weekends and I said, this is going to work, and I got it to work, and it gave immediate, obvious results.
And it worked.
Right.
That certainly must have been gratifying, I guess, in the way, again, of treatment of a patient who comes through some treatment well and is better and healthier and happier because of the treatment that you've given them, right? I mean, that must have the same kind of payoff. Maybe not as, again, when you're helping a particular person, the results can be much more rewarding simply because a gene probe isn't going to thank you. But I see it on the same level.
Well, we had a success in anything that's...
No, sure.
We knew what we wanted to do, and we did it. And anything that you do, whether it's a project in your house, fixing up your house or whatever it is, it's
cleaning
up
your room.
If you have a goal and you get to the end of it, it's satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but I think maybe perhaps a little more when the getting to the goal part is where the means and the methods are maybe a bit of a challenge, but where you've conquered them or you've made them work the way you want them to. Perhaps maybe even more rewarding than simply, I've got to clean up my room. Okay, I finally cleaned it up. Instead of developing this great new way to clean up your room, maybe in less time and also get it more organized or something like that, you feel more satisfied, I guess. These first 2 years, it sounds like you were like actually what seems to be the typical lab workers. The dream, you're here 80 hours a week, you come in at night, med students do it as well. And so you'd been doing it before, it's not that all of a sudden you were even working another 20 hours a week, because if you could, there wasn't even 20 more hours probably to do it. Did you finally just kind of burn out on this, or when you finally went from the training program, the fellow program, to actual academic position, was there just more responsibilities in another way that made this kind of concentrated effort difficult or annoying or...
Not really. I wasn't annoyed by it that much. I really cut down my hours a lot when I got married.
And this wouldn't have been, as you change over from being a fellow to an assistant professor, but about a year or so after, perhaps, or...
Yeah, about that.
This is probably, and as we're coming to the end, we did want to, at least I assume you won't, I think I talked to you, want to talk about your family and kind of end up there. That's what's happening now and is obviously important, not more important than anything else in your life right now. Maybe we should talk about how you, I'm going to call her Gretchen because I somehow misses or miss something, quite, even though I haven't met her. Where did you meet her? Here at the hospital or...
Yeah, she was in public relations here, mm-hmm. in the hospital, and it was important for her to know about new people that were coming on the staff, because if there was something interesting that they were doing that could result in some publicity for the hospital, then that was her job to make sure that happened, or if something was happening outside the university and the newspapers or television reporters needed some expert to talk about what was happening, then she would want to know who to call and who to get that from. Also, the goal, for her, the goal was, for promoting the hospital and the image of the hospital. But the point is that she as soon as I came in, came to talk to me and interview me and at least find out who I was, that mm-hmm. she would know whether, if she needed something from me, that she'd be able to do that. And That's how we met. We basically just met here in the hospital in the course of normal hospital business.
Right, and then whatever. So, we don't need a blow-by-blow detailed description of the courtship or anything like that. But was this really the first time, seriously, that you considered, marriage and family, or was that really not even that's just kind of happened without much consciousness of, it's time to settle down and raise a family, or...
No, I would have wanted to earlier, I would say. This was just the first relationship that led to engagement
right. And
marriage. But I probably would have been interested in doing it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to have a family for quite a while.
I know it's hypothetical, but that sometimes it's always a good way to perhaps get some insight into how people think and what's important to them. You think you would have been faced with the same issues, but earlier, of dividing your time properly between raising a family and a career and caring for people. We won't even put it in the terms of a career and making a name for yourself, as opposed to the responsibilities that are clear. You know, you feel it's clear the case that you feel you have them and need to pursue them as a doctor. Do you think it would have happened earlier had you met somebody else earlier where it led to that situation, or if you met Gretchen earlier, that you've been faced with these issues of how am I going to spend 85 hours a week at work and 85 hours a week at home?
That would have been an issue for sure. Yeah.
Has that been a difficult balancing act? I mean, is it still, or have you come to terms with it and handled it, and now it's just a matter of enforcing it and keeping it going? I can tell you why I asked, because when I first talked to you on the phone and I started talking about how to arrange this and my scheduling needs, and the very first thing you told me was that you had to be home at 8 p.m. or something. I think it was maybe it was 6 p.m. I'm not quite sure, but because that's when you had dinner with your family and you put your three daughters to bed. And that was, that didn't really matter if I had to stay an extra week or that sort of thing. I mean, this was the first and foremost, that was not going to be interfered with. So I noted that right away up here, not on a piece of paper, that this was something I had to talk about too as well on tape. And has it been difficult, or stressful, or?
Maybe slightly stressful, because sometimes I feel like I'm not doing all the things that the university might want me to be doing. Especially living away from here, living in the suburbs.
Were you living here earlier? I mean, before your family, you were living in Chicago? Or?
Yeah. And a lot of the real serious academic people do live in Hyde Park. And so they socialize with each other, they see each other, they can stay here longer. It's a little easier maybe to be part of the community, and maybe they get a lot more done that way. Know a lot more people, have more collaborations and ideas that way, whereas if you just leave, some of those things don't develop. So you could say it's a little bit stressful. It almost, it makes you wonder about, your longevity at the institution.
Okay, I thought you meant just your own health. Okay,
no.
You're taking it over.
But you are tenured or not.
I don't even know. You were all at this kind of point where you're either up for it or... you've just been up for it or that kind of thing, so I usually tend to avoid the subject.
No, I'm an assistant professor.
Okay. I don't know if the tenure system works.
I'm in a tenure track. So at some point, within 5 years of becoming an associate professor, I'd have to, be awarded tenure.
Of being an associate or an assistant?
Of being an associate, and I'm not even an associate yet, so.
But that's maybe a different length of time than in a more traditional, kind of PhD type program, like a biochemist or a molecular biologist, which seems to be, a 5 year. You came here, you got your associate assistant level done about 4 years ago? Five.
Yeah, 87. And I have a total of 7 years to get promoted to associate professor.
Okay, seven. Okay.
And then I have 5 years.
More typical, I guess, of like regular university departments.
Yeah, and then after that, I have 5 years to get tenure. So, it's a little bit stressful.
Mm-hmm. I take it this is still what you want, that you're not looking for just simply affiliation with a hospital, that you want to stay in academia. And again, you want to know about the newest way to treat strep throat and not just treat strep throat the same way that you've been treating it.
It's also because I'm a pediatric oncologist. You don't do pediatric oncology in private practice. You do it in university. And that doesn't mean you have to be writing a lot of papers and doing a lot of lab work, but you have to be involved in some kind of activities related to research.
What about teaching?
I noticed on your CV that in 1992 it was as you were going to be teaching molecular genetics to med students, I assume.
Yeah, that was just one. I give one lecture a year, and the first year I did that was last year. So,
okay. So you just teach one part of a course that's called molecular genetics.
Yeah, right.
And each one of you on the staff is, faculty does that teaches a specific part of it, or is there somebody who really does teach the class?
There's two people that are in charge of it that give most of the lectures, but they asked me to give one lecture just because.
So really your teaching response, your class type of teaching is very minimal as compared to, for instance, rounds.
Yeah, most of the teaching that I would do is rounds.
As I've told you, and I've probably said too many times on tape, you're my first, so if you could maybe either pick out some of the areas you'd like to discuss as your, what your duties and responsibilities, again, outside of treating patients and the research that you've done. I try to get some sense of the whole person here and what your responsibilities are and how you manage them and that sort of thing. Is that a daily kind of thing you're involved with, doing rounds? I get the impression, from your CV, that you're in charge of the pediatric rounds. I mean, it's your... No,
I'm not in charge of pediatric rounds, but
I'm really doing well here today.
Up until now, I'm in charge down on the ward just 1 month out of the year. And now that's changing because I've asked for a lot more clinical time and a lot less laboratory time.
So you'll be doing that more then?
Yeah.
Okay.
But whenever I am on so-called on service downstairs, then we do rounds every day, twice a day, in the morning and in the afternoon, and talk about all the patients. And in the context of that, make teaching points and comment on how the residents are handling the patients and try and readjust what they're doing to what we think is right, and that helps them to learn about it. And we also have lectures for them, which we'd be in charge of for that month.
Do you find
it's a lot of fun.
I was going to say, you find that a particularly rewarding part of what you do is, again, teaching clinical stuff to up-and-coming doctors.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Well, it's one group that's together for the whole month, and there's usually three residents, a fellow in training, and then myself. And so we're a team.
Mm-hmm.
We do things together. We learn together. We take care of the patients together, and it's a lot. It's really fun. You get to know them very well, and they learn a lot, and it's challenging. So it's really enjoyable. Of course, they do a lot of the hands-on work with the patients, whereas we just go around and schmooze with the moms and dads and tell them everything's okay, and they look up to us, the parents look up to us, but the hands-on work of drawing the blood and putting in the IVs and scheduling tests and all that stuff is basically done by the house staff that are here, which is, in one way, it's a super luxury. We just get to come in and make nice with everybody, mm-hmm. in terms of the families and the patients, and not have to be the ones to stick them with needles and so on. So in one way it's a super luxury. It's also a little bit standoffish from the patient,
mm-hmm.
and that that I don't like that much. I like being right in there.
Twice now that I've been here, you've taken the time that I used to either set up or take down my stuff, which I don't know, it still always takes me a while to go visit a patient. Has it been the same patient? I mean, just again.
Yeah, the two times was the same patient, right. That's been in the hospital.
Okay.
One of the patients that I follow as my own. Sort of as my own patient.
Mm-hmm. That's somebody who's come in through the system somehow, either referred to by his or her own pediatrician, or by he or she doesn't have one. In the case of many, I'm sure of many of the patients here, but somehow has gotten into the system, and you come along and you decide, okay, here's a patient I'm going to be responsible for, or does it get kicked up to you through the various levels of house staff because it's the patient presents a case that's particularly either difficult or particularly right up your alley, or...
Yeah, all the pediatric oncology patients have to be taken care of by either a fellow or a staff member that's specialized in pediatric hematology. So the residents don't take care of them on a long-term basis, just, when they're in the hospital.
Right.
And so when I'm on service,
you
or if I'm on call for the weekend, and if a new patient comes in, you immediately sort of bond with them and they look up to you, and either the fellow that you're working with or yourself becomes the primary responsible physician for them longitudinally until their treatment is finished or whatever and beyond. And so this was a patient that came in last time I was on service, which was in May
of
92.
And
so they come in, and she comes in out of the hospital for either complications or for treatment. No.
The entire time.
But I'm very, you know, I get very close with them, and they, and right now I'm not on service, so they have to deal with other doctors that they may not know as well.
Sure.
So I just go down every day, find out what's going on, see if they have any questions. If there's something I disagree with that the other people are doing to the patient, then I might go and talk to them and try and come to some kind of agreement about it.
Now you saw her on Saturday. Did you come in Sunday as well? No.
No, I just tell myself.
Well, I'd like to think that I was in to help some little patient downstairs, right? We wouldn't normally come in on a Saturday, maybe, or maybe you would, and I'm just...
No, but if I'm here, I have to go down to see
you.
Sure,
You were here because of me, so I had something to do with that, right?
That's right. But I just tell the mom, I'll see you Monday. My beeper's on, you know. And if she had any major problem or she just, you know, was upset by anything at all, then she could call the operator and have me paged, you know, that kind of thing.
One of the other things that I noticed on on your CV that intrigued me that I didn't, you know, really know there's something to talk about, but perhaps given the way the interview's gone, it might be a good way to go. Is this? It's a program, I guess, here about not cancer prevention, but it's risk evaluation or something like that. I mean, you.
Yeah. Well, the cancer risk clinic. That's another area where I might get a patient, even if I'm not in service,
right.
Because I kind of specialize in patients that have a genetic susceptibility to developing cancer. And one kind of patient like that is the patients with retinoblastoma. So pretty much any patient with retinoblastoma who comes in, I eventually become their doctor because I'm recognized as the person that's interested in that here. And there's a whole bunch of other categories of patients who...
Or they're maybe precancerous.
Who either don't have cancer but have a condition that predisposes to cancer, or they have cancer and it was recognized that the reason they got cancer was because they had a genetic predisposition. So we evaluate them and explain to the patient or the family, you know, what the, you know, about the genetics, you know, teach them about the genetics of the situation and what, you know, how all this came about, as well as to tell them what the risks are that individual might get another cancer in the future, or that, you know, a sibling or other relative might be at risk, and try and identify which people in the family are at risk and what they should do about it.
Now, okay, so this isn't just you. This is a we. You said we. Could you give me some idea if I know who's...
Well, I'm the pediatrician. There's one pediatrician involved, and then there's a medical oncologist involved whose name is Dr. Fumi Olapati. And then we have a genetic counselor. So the three of us are the sort of the critical team. And we see patients in clinic, and we do a lot of the work over the telephone for patients that don't live around here. And otherwise, if the patients are in the hospital here, or... you know, are being treated here, then we, you know, see them there.
Whose idea was this? Was this something that was here that you've just gotten involved in? Maybe replace somebody else? Is this something you said we need and started? Is this...
Yeah, it's something that I said I want to do.
Okay. And so you found, I didn't really catch it. I assume it was a him. That may not
no,
be.
It's a female. Dr. Olapati is a female.
Olapati?
Fumi Olapati.
Fumi, okay.
And, I decided I wanted to do it. You know, I went to the higher up people and said, I want to start this clinic. I'm really interested in these kind of patients, and I'd like to have a place for them to go, and I'd like to attract more patients like this down here. And and they said, well, that's fine. You know, we want to, there's somebody else that happens to be, you know, the right kind of person for this, who could take care of the adults and you could take care of the kids, and we'll give you some money to buy a genetic counselor.
Do they come cheaply? No, I'm kidding.
And we'll see how the program goes, and if it's really successful, and if it brings a lot of patients down here and so forth, or if it, you know, increases our visibility and helps a lot of the patients, that will keep it going.
So how long has it been running? I mean, how long has it been?
Just 10 months.
And can you say it's been six, you know, that it may be meeting your expectations?
Yeah, it's been really great. Yeah, it's been really great.
And you think it's meeting hospitals, well, or the higher-ups, the powers that be, so that it will be around for a while?
I think so, yeah. We get a lot of phone calls from people. There's a lot of people that are concerned about why they got cancer, and many people that think it's on a family basis. And so there's a lot of people that want to talk about it. And in addition to that, we've really, you know, met up with some really amazing families that have a lot of cancer in their family that we may be able to be helpful to.
What about the situation that just a general understanding? I know I understand with leukemias and things like that, there really is the genetic, and I don't mean just genetic, the question of heritable diseases. And this being, in many cases, a lot of leukemias are probably related to that. As far as I know, right, or am I just, as opposed to the genetic alterations or transformations coming about from environmental carcinogens and then coupled with perhaps heritable genetic disorders or abnormalities. What do you think about other situations where, as you say, some amazing families where cancer is...
Leukemia is not a big player in this inherited type. It's in adults, breast cancer is major. There's a major genetic component in breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some families where there's just isolated occurrences and there's no evidence of any genetic, but there's some families where there's clearly a genetic pattern of transmission of susceptibility to the disease. And the same thing's true for, there's a certain percentage of colon cancer that's hereditary. Mm-hmm. And this, it involves huge numbers of patients because these are diseases that are very, very common.
Right.
So breast cancer and colon cancer are really the big players in adults. And in kids, it's much less in terms of numbers, but retinoblastoma, about 40% of patients with retinoblastoma have a genetic form of the disease so that they can pass it on to their offspring. So half of their offspring would be at a very high risk. It's almost a certainty that they would get retinoblastoma. And then there's quite a few other situations, but they're all very low frequency. If you add them all up together, it becomes a significant number of patients.
What about the role of gene therapy, especially with the inherited, these kind of cancers? Does this clinic kind of work mainly as just an advice and a place for these people to come and talk about these issues and maybe learn more about their situation and the situation for offspring and things like that? Or is it also perhaps a way for people like you who are interested in doing further work with this to collect data, to start, doing prospective analyses as opposed to retrospective?
It's a forum for research as well. We're setting up a computer database so that all the families that come in, the information is recorded. We're doing studies. We're involved with different studies. Some of the studies involve using drugs to prevent cancer in people that are susceptible, and that's really exciting. It's also those are the main things. Studying prevention techniques, as well as all the counseling that goes on.
And you don't see this kind of work or the collection of this kind of data as helping something like, again, advances in gene therapy or things like that? Or is that not really an area that's seen as...
Well, gene therapy doesn't really apply very well to this group of patients. These are, there are people that have deficiencies of a gene. Where you can, if you can give the gene to the right cells of the body, then you can correct it. Like, for example, if somebody has an immune defect, an immune deficiency, because they don't have a certain gene, then you take out their bone marrow, you add the gene to those cells using viral transmission vectors, you give the bone marrow back to the patient, it grows in the body, and it gives them a healthy immune system. But for cancer susceptibility, for example, for retinoblastoma, you can't replace the gene in the retinal cells because unless you transplanted the eye, and of course that's not possible. That's impossible. We can't do that. You'd have to you'd have to remove their eye and then or you'd have to somehow get the.
You'd have to be doing therapy on the parents' genes or something strange like that, where that gene wouldn't be passed on, which is again a very frightening.
The techniques aren't fully available yet, although I suppose
that
it could be possible. Mm-hmm. If you could do it at the embryo stage.
Doing it in mice, apparently. Knocking out their genes. They're not adding another kid.
Yeah.
But it's germline cells that they're messing around with, certainly, or can mess around with now.
Right.
Very frightening. At the same time, who knows, maybe from someone from your perspective also, maybe very exciting. although there are all sorts of ethical questions about messing around with your own cells in humans, and perhaps maybe as controversial now, or it will become soon, as any kind of as the cloning was back in the early 70s, when people was, oh my God, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have giants and people living till they're 700 and things like that. We are kind of coming near the close of the interview and of the tape, and I guess really before we do, is there something, you know, you want to say? Do you want to say something nasty to somebody at the pew, or hello to your mom, or you know, or do you have something you'd like to add? I got a sense that we're a little reluctant to do this, or not really gung-ho. Some of your colleagues, of course, just can't wait to talk about themselves. And in this context, I think that's a good thing. Would you say maybe the experience has changed your mind a little bit, that it's been, who knows, some sort of therapy, and I don't mean that you need therapy, but this, going through this process has been a positive thing?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I go through the process anyway, but it was
a lot of total stranger now.
It was a lot of fun to recall a lot of things from early childhood. For myself, it was fun to think about some people and some things that I hadn't thought about in a long time.
No, it's supposed to have that. I think that, or hope, had that effect too, that this is not just something you're doing for either some previously, you know, very kind granting agency, or for me, or for the history of medicine in the future. It also has a something good, you know, it has an effect on what you do too. I mean, you get something out as well. And you say it was good for me to recall those things. It's actually very, I think it was, well, it's very good for other people as well that you did. It's a very interesting and I thought very carefully thought out, and yet also fresh, kind of spontaneous recounting of your childhood. That's that is very interesting. I have nothing more to add except to say thank you for your time. I do appreciate it. I know you're very busy, and it is hard to, yet again, with your full-time job and a family at home, to squeeze yet another 7 or 8 or 9 hours worth of time in just a matter of 4 or 5 days. So I do appreciate it. You've been very gracious, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay.